Hello, Dragonfly Nation. This is the Canadian Bushcraft Podcast, episode 139, with your host, Caleb Musgrave, and Rye the Adventure Guy. We are here with our good friend, Tegan Legg from Haliburton Forest, and we're going to be talking all about Haliburton Forest and wildlife, as well as her time here, her experiences, all these kind of fun stories of hers, and all the programs that are happening up here. So, stay tuned.
To know the landscape is to open up a door. Feel deeper connected than you've ever felt before. We know that you will love this podcast. So shut your mouth and listen to Canadian Bushcraft.
Hey there, folks. We're here today at the Cliffside Cabin in the deep woods of Haliburton Forest and Wildlife with a very long time friend of mine, Tegan Legg. Tegan and I met back in about 13, 14 years ago, pretty much around the time that you were starting off here.
Yeah, exactly.
My wife, at the time, friend, who then became girlfriend about a year or two later, and then...
You're welcome.
Yes, you were part of that. You were part of that. I'm not going to deny that whatsoever. Kept calling me freaking Jacob from Twilight and shit. But anyways, they were working together. I got to connect with Tegan and her beautiful husband, lovely husband, Andy. Andrew, my apologies. You prefer Andrew. I prefer calling him Andy. The first time I met Andrew was about the same time I met you, and it was at Emmy's party. She was having that barbecue.
Right.
And Andrew was running late, and he pulls up. He goes, "Hey, yeah? Are you Caleb? Yeah. You're the bushcraft guy? Yeah. Do you want moose bones? Yeah." And he just reached into his truck and started hucking moose leg bones at me and rib bones that he just found on a job site somewhere.
Sounds about right.
So I met Tegan around, I would say, 2009?
I started at the forest at 2009, yeah. So it would have been, and Emily was there a little bit before
me. Yeah, she got there around 2007, 2008.
Yep.
And at the time we were just friends, and then about a year or two later we... started dating, and it was a lot because of you. You and Bree basically harassing her nonstop. I think Emmy had something to do with it too. We're just name dropping people now.
We essentially told Emily that she needed to be with somebody that enjoyed pelts and bushcraft stuff. And lo and behold, Caleb walks in dressed in furs to the nines at a wild game dinner in Haliburton. And we were like, hello, right there.
That guy. Yeah. So. That's how that all started. And at first you were working in the office. You were just like,
yeah, I did work. A mix of stuff. Yeah. I was hired for accounts payable for the sawmill, which made no sense. I had no background in it, but I really wanted to work at Haliburton Forest.
Right.
So I was doing that, and I was working at the dog kennels. That's where Emily and I connected, working front office, canopy tour guide, wherever they
needed something.
They had a hole. I filled it.
Right. So, good pun there. Anyways, with all that said, what got you to come to Haliburton? Like, what in the hell made you be like, I need to work here? Like, where are you from? Who are you?
So I'm originally from a little town called Garson, just outside of Sudbury. I grew up in one of 12 of the original houses across from the mine that I worked at. It was built for the miners and everything. And I grew up just hanging out in the woods, you know. I would be gone for hours on my bike, blueberry picking off of railroad tracks and, you know, going on adventures and camping with my family and everything. So when I went to high school, I took outdoor ed, fell in love with it. You know, everybody was on that trajectory to go to university at that time that was drilled into us, but I found an outdoor ed program at Cambrian College.
Yep.
So it was nature-based adventure tourism. I knew I needed something a little bit more than that to kind of continue to actually have a career in it. So I ended up finding a course in Haliburton called Nature-Based Adventure Tourism Management at the time.
Right.
Sorry, Ecotourism and Adventure Tourism Management. And I took that course. And so that had my partner and I move to Haliburton at that time. And we fell in love with the area. You know, there's events and rolling hills and hiking and all of this stuff. I ended up working kind of part-time for Algonquin Outfitters, a company called, or an organization called Trails and Tours. So they used to maintain all the trails across the county. I helped organize the Haliburton Festival, all these different things. But during that journey, I had met the bishops. Mm. Val Bishop was one of my professors and a mentor of mine throughout college. Mm. She was like our second mom. She adopted us when we moved to Halliburton.
Well, I had a professor named Val Bishop.
You
the
did.
Same one?
Probably. In college, yeah. At Fleming, yeah.
Sweet. There yeah. you go. There Small you go. World
there you
again.
Go.
The outdoor adventure world.
Yeah, yeah. So we lived in her basement for a summer. Like, she saved us because a rental fell through on us and all these different things. And that's where I met Dave Bishop. And I was working at Trails and Tours at the time. He had actually left the forest for a little bit, kind of on a sabbatical. We worked together. And when he came back to the forest, I kept saying, "Hey, you got a job for me? Hey, you got a job for me?" And eventually he had a job for me and I found myself here.
Right on.
Yeah.
And from there you went from shoveling dog shit and helping people on canopy tours to becoming the vice president of tourism.
Yeah, general manager, vice president, whatever.
Terminology, fair enough. The work you do now, you focus mostly, so there's like several divisions of Halliburton Forest. Most businesses, when they get big, they got to divide up and make sure that some sort of control is happening. So there's a logging and forestry division. There's a tourism division. Is there any other divisions that I'm forgetting here?
Nope. Well, kind of. So we call it forest products. We call it tourism and recreation. Mm-hmm. And then you could look at that. There's a third one, which is research. Right. And education. So
right.
It's not necessarily a business venture, but it is a huge component of what we do.
Totally.
And it fits in obviously with everything that we do, but we kind of look at it as like a little branch off of the big company.
Totally. And that's going to connect with things like forestry technician work, because they're looking at the biology and the ecology. So research goes in there. You have a wolf center that has a captive wolf pack that are doing really flipping well. I've been in love with that center since I first came here 14, 15 years ago and just fell in love with that place. And it's used for research. There's like, mm-hmm. there was like a blind built in there for research to be able to come in and study at one point.
Yeah. Yeah. So the original purpose, for the Wolf Center was, number one, the people that originally had the wolves couldn't take care of them anymore. We're friends with our owner then, Peter Schleifenbaum. Mm-hmm. And we took them on, thinking that it was only going to be for research purposes. So that the old tower, you've probably been up it.
I've seen it. I haven't been up it because I don't like
that's true. You don't
being
like
high. And B, I just feel kind of sketchy walking into a wolf den just to go up, climb into a fake tree and look down at them.
Yeah. Well, I've been in it a few times. It's
really?
Pretty neat. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're like, 10, 20 feet from you. You're looking through a screen. It's a neat tower. So the idea was, observation for research and everything. But it just happened that a lot of people caught wind and were watching the wolves through the fence and stuff. So it became disruptive. Mm-hmm. And that's where Peter and his team built a wolf center to kind of control that. So mm-hmm. it's an Ontario signature experience.
Yep.
It is world renowned. We have people traveling from all over the world to come and see it, because it is one of the only facilities of its kind where the wolves are as wild as they can be in captivity.
Yep.
So the only time, we kind of interfere is we do have a duty of care. Mm-hmm. So we do things like deworm. We go in when there's pups and just,
make sure they're doing okay.
Yeah, exactly. Make sure they're doing okay. But we also don't want to go over our carrying capacity in the enclosure. So occasionally we have to take a pup out or something, so we're not having too many wolves in the enclosure. But overall, they fight for dominance, they breed, they do everything they would in the wild. We just have to feed them. But they get everything they would in the wild. Beaver, deer, moose,
You and Cam brought a roadkill deer and a rabbit yeah. in just
oh,
the
yeah.
other day.
Yeah, yeah. It's always an adventure when you're picking up a roadkill off the side of the highway. The whole community knows to call Halliburton Forest. Yeah, there's lovely scents and insects that crawl all over the place and people giving you weird looks when you're on the side of the road trying to haul a deer in the back of a truck.
There's even the trappers in the area will bring in like their beaver carcasses and stuff to you once they take the pelts off. And
Yeah, we get a mix for sure. And we pay the local trappers. Mm-hmm. We actually try to get with fur on
really?
Because they need the minerals and nutrients.
Of course.
But that's where we supplement with deer and moose.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely, anytime anybody has any extra beavers lying around, we're happy to take them. But we also have some trappers that provide us beavers all the time. So.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And it really is an incredible facility when you go there. When I first went in, again, 15 years ago was the first time I ever traveled here and went in there and checked it out, I was just blindsided. You have like almost like a one-way mirror or like a the window viewing screen is so that they can't see us, but we can see them. And so you just see these wolves lounging or playing or fighting or breeding napping. Season or napping. Yeah, all these different things.
I once had to explain to children on Family Day weekend what Mommy and Daddy were doing out there.
Did Emily ever show you the photos from when she was a teenager in Outdoor Ed?
No.
So one of the first times I hung out at her place, she walks up to me and she goes, so we're at Kinark. And I found this set of wolf tracks, and my teacher was baffled. So I took a photo with my Polaroid camera, and I'm looking at it, and sure enough, there's two tracks facing forward, two tracks wider facing forward, and two tracks narrower facing forward, all kind of almost like in a circle, but all facing forward. It's not like they walked around in a circle. And she's looking at it, I'm looking at it, I look at her, and I look at it, and I look at her, and I go, what time of year was this? She goes, February. I'm like, when's breeding season for wolves? And she goes, February. Oh. And I was like, your teacher probably knew. He just didn't want to say to a 15-year-old girl,
yep.
Oh, they're having sex.
Yep. Yep.
But yeah, just we were there at the Wolf Center again yesterday, and we were getting to watch. Which wolf was that was blowing out their fur?
I believe it was Uriel.
Uriel? Okay.
Yeah, Uriel.
Which I've never got to see with a wild wolf or any wolf. Right. You see it with almost every animal, but I've never seen a wolf looking like a half-sheared sheep. Just covered in this woolly fur under hair stuck all over.
Had like a little magic carpet underneath it. Yeah. It was just all the back had already shed. And then the bottom was, yeah, like a Swiffer.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I called it a demented Wolverine. Just the way it had like this light color rim, like the wolves, the Wolverine does with that little blonde crown on their fur.
It's hard to not want to go in there and like pull the fur off like you brush your household dog, but then you realize it'll eat you.
It's a wolf. Yeah. And it's an amazing facility. Beyond that, they've got like this whole hall of taxidermy of showing like the ecology that a wolf would be living in. You've got like moose and deer and fishers and foxes and skunks and porcupines and loons. Although the loon taxidermy, like it's also for if you're fascinated by bad taxidermy and you keep an eye out there, you'll see some really funny things if you just keep an eye out a little bit, because some of these stuffed animals are from like 30 years ago.
Oh yeah, for sure.
40 years ago.
I think some of them came from like
old cabins and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, there's been a lot of donations over the years.
There's this loon there that looks like it's trying to perch like a robin. It just doesn't look right whatsoever for the
it's standing upright on land, which they're not physically capable of doing.
It is not anatomically correct by any means.
Maybe we leave it in there just for humor.
Yeah. Well, like so here's one thing, folks. If you come to Halberton Forest, go to the Wolf Center and look for Easter eggs in the bad taxidermy. Look for bad taxidermy and get back to us on what you saw. Send us photos on our Instagram, things like that, whatever you can. Because I love bad taxidermy. I also like really good taxidermy. But going in there, you have a mix of both, but you don't know what you're looking at until you really look at it.
Yep.
Like there's a beautiful golden eagle in there. And I love golden eagles. I like them over bald eagles and most other birds of prey. And it's not just because it's my native name, but like I love them. And when you're looking at it, it looks so majestic and beautiful. And you realize its head is kind of...
Oh, yeah. It's totally in an odd
down in a weird 90. Like, it's looking straight at its belly button. And then you look at its talons, you realize this used to be, like, standing, not flying. And you guys just put it up with lines to make it look like it's flying. Just working with what you got. Which is brilliant to me. I think that taxidermy should be kind of campy and dorky.
But you're also depriving the people. Because the best of the worst was in the basement when we were there. You saw a good fox. Yes. There was another bobcat that had like wild Jack
really
Nicholson
crazy
smile
eyes.
On him.
Yeah.
I gave these guys the full basement tour. We went in the meat locker and saw all the bad, really bad taxidermy.
The fox was just kind of dorky looking. Like he had like a derp look to his face. There, it was the fact that there was a fisher on display that had like this needle nose, like a pair of pliers. And I'm like, they're my favorite animal to trap is the Fisher Martens. They don't look like that. Then we go downstairs and there's a perfect Fisher Marten in the hidden away. We don't want anyone seeing this well put together Fisher.
And this is why we're working with Ryan and Caleb to try and fix some of these displays.
Doing some consultation work, yeah. My favorite one though that's not on display is the deer carcass.
Yes.
Taxidermy. Yeah. It used to be on display.
Yep.
It's a deer torso that they've trimmed off to make it look like a wolf has opened up the rib cage and the guts and the blood is out. Clearly you can't display that for most people. Some people get pretty upset when they see that stuff. I still say get a taxidermied wolf pup and put it in the body cavity so everybody thinks it's cute. That's my theory. And they do that. They will get inside and like the babies will climb in and start eating whatever they can. So it's a realistic setting, but like it's also hilarious.
I think it would be very underappreciated. Aside from people like us.
The real people that actually know what they're talking about would love it.
Yeah.
You'd have that one family that think they went to Disneyland and they realized we are not at Disneyland.
Until they go to the kiddies corner.
Yes.
Where we have magnifying glass and kids can look at fur and bones. Mm-hmm. There's stories and arts and crafts that they can do. And
there's the hallway of photos of like wolves through history. And then you get to the back room and there's like all the other animals. Like you got skeletons and tracks from small rodents, from snapping turtles and their eggs, all the way to black bear. There's a full black bear pelt in there.
Mm-hmm. Tracks and scat. So it's really neat because it's, you know, teaching the generations coming up how like what tracks look like and what scat and stuff when they're walking in the woods, they'll hopefully be able to retain some of that information.
And it was really like kind of full circle fun for us because we did that. And then later in the day, and I don't want to skip too far ahead, we went to a shooting range that you guys set up in the last year.
Yep.
And while we're walking in, Dean's like, you're going to see a lot of moose tracks. We find a lot of moose tracks here and we get almost past the first shooting point and they get to the second shooting point and there's just bear tracks.
It was incredible. I've been paying attention to tracks my entire life and I can't remember a time where I've been able to follow a bear. Mm-hmm. It was really neat. Like they were very well defined.
And it was a young one that had the, and what was exciting to me was like, not exciting, but like fascinating was like when I was in the wolf center, I was looking at your bear track display. I was like, that's a pretty small set of paws for a black bear. Mm-hmm. Get out there. It was the exact same size as the one that we were tracking. Okay, so that's the black bear they have here right now. Okay, got it.
Yep.
Like, it was just like just the size of my palm plus the toes kind of stretching out from there. Beautiful set of tracks out there in the bush. Mm-hmm. But it's just a phenomenal, just like that one center alone up here is so special and so unique and so underappreciated and like almost undersold.
Mm-hmm.
Like you guys have some phenomenal stuff in there beyond just the actual living pack of wolves that are just right across the glass.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember one time being there when Haida was alpha or just before he became alpha of the pack. I missed that wolf. There was a raven eating some scrap. And Haida got up and stretched. And wolves and ravens always have had this relationship. There's a reason that Odin has two ravens and two wolves with him in the mythology. There's a reason you see Ojibwe paintings, the medicine style paintings of wolves and ravens. You see it all over around the northern hemisphere. They have a relationship. Ravens in Winter and Mind of a Raven, the author of those books, I believe was Heinlein or Heinrich. One was the guy that wrote Starship Troopers. The other guy wrote a book on two books on ravens. My apologies, I can't remember right now. And I'm saving my reception for not research, but for recording. But even in his books, talking about like why ravens make certain calls for this, like to bring in the wolves, to open the cadaver or the carcass or whatever they got. Because the ravens themselves, they have this intimate relationship. And I'm thinking about all these things when I'm watching this wolf stretching and napping beside this raven who's plucking away some chunks of meat. And then Haida lunged at the raven who tried to fly away. Smoked itself in the one-way window.
Oh, no.
Hit the ground, and Haida began to eat it. And I was just like, this is beautiful. It just destroyed all the romanticism I had in my brain and reminded me that this is just a fucking animal that does what an animal does.
Yep.
And it was just like, I would have kept that stupid romanticized notion for so long if I didn't just watch a wolf trick a raven into killing itself on a window just so it could have a second snack that day. Like, it's a really special place for that. And then beyond there, you have...
Well, that was my introduction to the forest, was the Wolf Center.
Mm-hmm.
My family friend had talked about it for about a decade, even before I got into outdoor education. That was all I ever heard was, it's a cat wolf pack up in Halliburton. Like, she was like, you gotta go there.
Right.
And then I eventually came... Oh, and then when I told her that, oh yeah, I'm starting to work with them, so...
Yep.
She was pretty excited about that. Feels like it's come full circle as well.
No, it's an incredible place. You know, like I'm just as guilty as everyone else. My bedroom was clad with wolves and raccoons. Like, I collected, I had pictures, I had everything everywhere. And when I started at the forest, it was unbelievable to me that I got to, like, not necessarily work at the center all the time, but occasionally, and then go over and help feed and different things, right? And I just count my blessings every day that I get to do that. It's so cool. And our staff are incredible. Like, Mariah, who works there, is actually been up to Algonquin Park and has done radio collaring and, mm-hmm. and everything with the researchers
Marina
up there.
Mariah.
Okay. Marina grew up coming to Haliburton Forest. She has a cottage. So Marina's our Wolf Center coordinator. She has a cottage on Kinesis Lake, and she's done our summer camps. She's been going to the Wolf Center. She learned from the great Paul Brown, who was our Wolf Center coordinator for years. And so the team is really tight, right? Like, we're always looking at fish and wildlife students and biology, mm-hmm. and Jen McKay, who's there, you know, has biology background, and you know, and yeah, you're not just coming and it's a summer student. That we might have some people here and there floating around helping check you in. Mm-hmm. But it's an educational facility, right? And, and wolves are so important to our ecology, and that's what we're trying to strive to, you know, educate everybody about.
Especially, like, and I'm not going to try and get too much into politics here, but from here up to Algonquin Park is a very contentious area, mm-hmm. where it comes down to wolves and their role in the ecology. People, I've driven by people between here and Huntsville with bumper stickers that say smoke a pack a day, and they got a wolf in the crosshairs as an image.
Right.
There's people here that, not here at Haliburton Forest necessarily, but people in the region that vehemently hate wolves and blame them on why they didn't get a deer this year or a moose this year, why the moose are having a crash. And then you have people who are, like I was at one point, over-romanticizing these wolves and being like, these wolves are so magical and special and they do all the work for everyone in the wilderness. When it's somewhere in between that, which Haliburton Forest gets to showcase, they're not magical wood fairies. They're not like this romantic animal that is completely infallible in every way. But without them, the whole place falls apart.
Exactly. Look at Yellowstone.
Just like Michigan as well, how they started having the airdrop wolves just because
of Isle Royale and everything.
For sure.
Yeah, wolves are a mess. We've had this talk on the coyote episode. We've got to do a wolf episode soon. I'm hoping for my buddy Ethan to be available for that one. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know anyone that knows more about wolves than Ethan, personally. Mm-hmm. Maybe Paul Brown, but I can't get a hold of him. But yeah, the wolf is a magical animal. And they're a symbol of the North. They're a symbol of Haliburton. They're a symbol of Haliburton Forest.
Yeah.
They're a being that we need to admire as much as we have to also figure a way to live with them, because they can cause some trouble here and there, but not as much as they actually help, in my opinion. That's my own personal opinion. Anyways, beyond the Wolf Center, you also have facilities like a canopy tour. You have facilities like day passes for hiking, canoeing, camping, things like that, multi-day passes, all that kind of stuff, as well as more recently a gun range, which we got to check out yesterday. It's a skeet shooting range specifically, not long range, though that may happen one day. Who knows? Who knows what happens down the line? Like, that's kind of the fun of every time I come to Haliburton.
Yeah.
Like, the last time I was up for more than a day or so to have a meeting with you folks, mm-hmm. was 2019 when we were looking for birch bark.
Yeah.
Me and Christina, you, one of our staff. Christina, if you're listening, hi. Andy says hi, too. We miss you. Ryan says hi as well. Tegan does. I'm speaking on behalf of everybody now. Haha, I'm with everybody, you're not.
We miss you.
She's with the Gilmores.
Exactly, that's why I'm doing this. Because she was in Newfoundland with the Gilmores, and I wasn't. So, neener, I'm with Andy and Dig. But anyways, I basically put out a post, like, we're looking for bark. We need to get this canoe built. We had a plan fall through on us, or a deal fall through on us, and you messaged me kind of out of the blue, and like, we have spots. I don't know what the bark quality is like, but if you want to come up and you can do it without killing the trees, try it out.
Yep.
And so me, my wife, and Christina came up for like 4 days, cruising around with Andy, who literally took time off work just to take us around the park or the forest and let us find birch. And we didn't find much for canoe work, which is what we're there for, but we found some really like phenomenal basket bark. And at the time, that it had been like a decade since I was here last, like almost, it was about 7 years since I was here last, because Emily left the forest in 2012. So we both moved further south. coming back and like hearing like, oh, the force has changed hands. I'm now the general manager. This is going on. This is happening. The submarine is no longer functioning.
Yep.
And it's just like, that was a huge change in 7 years. And then since then, in the 4 years that has been, there's been other massive changes. There's a gun range now. There's like all these different facilities opening up across the park, the forest, which is like, we're sitting in this beautiful freaking cabin that is cozy, but not hot when it was hot out. The breeze is perfect. We're on top of one of the most scenic cliffs I've been to in Ontario. This beautiful place that you have here, like at this little tiny oasis. I said to you earlier when we were waiting for the phone to charge for the recording, I stepped outside to have a quick smoke and I just saw one light in all the darkness. Yeah. There was one little tiny cabin way off on the other end of the lake over there, below us by like 200-300 feet. And then way off in the distance by multi-kilometers. Like, it is one of the most remote places you can be in central Ontario.
You can fit a lot in 100,000 acres, so.
Yeah exactly. Yeah. And it's awesome, right? And that's what keeps me around and gets me excited. Every single day is different, and we get to kind of develop things, but in a way that keeps things feeling private and secluded and wilderness, right? Like, when I first started working here, we had 50,000 acres of property, and that doubled over the course of my career here. And we have over 100,000 acres. We have 100 lakes. We have over 400 wetlands and, you know, ponds and streams and everything, billions of trees, obviously, and over 400 kilometers of trails and roads and everything, right? So we had a core infrastructure that had been built over the years by Peter and David and, you know, everybody that... came well before me. But now our team, you know, myself and Cameron, our operations manager, Pete Kundle, our lease and land use manager, and our incredible team have this opportunity to bring more in, right? I always like to say this, and this might be a little controversial, how I'm going to say this, but as long as we are distracting, you know, our shareholders over here with cool things that are bringing money in, then they're less likely to lose interest. Yeah. Right. And do something else with the property. So we, you know, make partnerships with companies like Cabinscape. We have 13 tiny home cabins that you can rent across the property. We just lease those campsites to those, to that company, but they maintain, they take all their own reservations. They have their own housekeeping, but it gives people an opportunity to stay in these remote locations within the forest. Some are right on water. They can't see any neighbors. Some are like bunkies that are really appealing to our snowmobilers because our accommodations can be full, particularly in the winter. So looking at different options, you know, we're putting in new campsites. Some of them are camp canoeing. Some of them are car camping. You know, we were hoping to look at a couple of them today. We went out to a couple group campsites. So that's always growing. When we closed down the submarine, we turned the submarine shed into an accommodation that people can rent, right? Yep. So it's really fun, really, really, really fun being able to do that. And that's the same with this cabin, right? I'm glad you said it because I've been toting it as the most incredible view in all of Ontario that you can drive up to.
Yeah.
And you get to rent it. There's nothing else here. There's nothing else here. It's just this cabin. You know, hydro, water, everything that like you this need.
I've been going on and on, like, there's more amenities here than my own house. we're officially off, by the way, folks, we're officially off grid now. It's finally done. We just got to finish actually making the place nicer for us. But there's, like, flushing toilets, running water that's clean to drink immediately without having to do heavy labor on your end. You have power. We've got, like, fans and lights around us right now. We're able to charge our phones while we're doing all this work here. All the while, there's a view out there that has like the Elk Hunter music from Last of the Mohicans every time you look out the damn window.
Yeah, and a nice big fire pit right next to a fully stocked woodshed and everything too. Yep. So you don't even have to leave.
Yep, barbecue, everything's right here that you need.
Does Uber Eats come up here too?
They don't go anywhere.
I mean, you did you did deliver food the other night.
Yeah, that is true. You were the Uber.
I am the Uber Eats. Alberta representative. There you go.
There we go. And I'm not going to get into like the price point of this place, but I will tell you right now, I've paid a lot more for less.
Right.
To stay a night in a place. Yeah. This is, the price here is completely acceptable and completely understandable for a facility like this. And frankly, a little under
Like, oh, for sure. For sure. And you know what? All of our accommodations are, because we, you know, ultimately just want people to come and enjoy the property, you know, learn a little bit about nature, and that's going to foster an appreciation for conservation and for forests. Right. Totally. So if you look into any of our accommodations, they're going to be more cost effective than any hotel or Airbnb that you could stay in. Mm-hmm. They all have cooking facilities, but then of course we have Trust Food Works that's right on site. So we have this amazing smokehouse. We've had two meals there this week. And they've just partnered with Boshkong and have actually taken that over. So I think you got the Forest Amber Lager. I don't think you've tried it yet.
I've had it before.
Have you? Yeah. Right? So we have our own branded beer, you know, all these different really cool things that are going on. And then, campsites, hiking trails. I always say to people, and I know Peter would cringe at me saying this, but it's a lot like a provincial park in the aspects of the outdoor recreation that you can do here, but we're privately owned. And I would even say, and people might boo me later, but the campsites here are nicer than anything and more private than what you would get at a provincial park. And I love provincial parks. I've gone to them my entire life and I still continue to do so with my children. But if you're looking for something that's a little bit more wilderness, if you were interior, what we get is a lot of people that were interior campers, they've had kids, they don't necessarily want to canoe or hike into sites with the kids. They come here and they do car camping and still kind of get that same feel as what they would have hiking. And that's the kind of feedback that we're getting, right? And that's what we want. We want people to have that experience. We never want to have campsites on top of each other. And
well, that was what was like really like impressing me the last, like today, especially when we went for our ATV cruise with Pete. Me and Rye took out a Can-Am with Pete to check out a bunch of different properties. So just to let people know why we're up here. Ryan and I are looking at a few places for possible leasing to run courses further north. So we've been teaching for 15 years almost down in the Peterborough region. We want to get a little bit more wilderness into Canadian bushcraft. We both are wilderness guides from our past. We both teach a lot of wilderness skills. That's what Canadian bushcraft is all about. Kind of hard to do that when on a long weekend you're hearing Lady Gaga down the pond from where we're teaching. Here, when we're out for the cruise just to check out all these different possible leases, like, you'd see a campsite, and then 15 minutes later, you see a campsite, and then 15 minutes later, you see a campsite. We're doing 50 kilometers an hour with the way the turns and the hills were. 50 kilometers an hour, and every 15 minutes is when we'd see another campsite. Like, that is long-distance remoteness between campsites that are on the lake shores. Like, that was something that really, like, impressed upon me, like... You don't get that in Algonquin Park when there's campsites. It's like the campsites are within 50 to 100 yards of each other.
It's like a subdivision. Everyone's shoulder to shoulder in most parks like that. Even backcountry, you get a lot of lakes where they're trying to put as many backcountry sites because the demand is high.
And then you go to like places like Bon Echo, which no shade on Bon Echo. I love being at Mazinaw Lake. I love doing the programs there. I love seeing all the stuff there. But the main campground is basically a Walmart parking lot with 15 trees in it. Like you are literally elbow to elbow with the next person next door. And we were talking about this earlier, most parks, almost every provincial park is booked solid by the opening of bookings. Whereas here there's access still. And there's always like you and your crew just finished building like how many more campsites in the last few months?
I would say in the last 2 years we've probably put in a dozen or so. And then we're still continuing to do so. And as I said earlier, right, like there was 50,000 acres, now there's 100. So we're able to spread that out. And kind of develop stuff. And the newest ones are canoe and campsites. And then the ones that we checked out at Snap Lake. So some of those will be hike in access. Some of them will be canoe in access. And you know, just kind of keeping that spread out. And that's not to say that you're not going to see somebody while you're out there and hear other people, but you still get that feeling like you can maybe walk around your campsite naked if you really wanted to.
Here to her first. She
says, you just call me. The general manager of Halliburton Forest's Tours Division.
But that's not all the campsites. Read the descriptions.
Yes. Check out your remoteness. I keep coming back to Cliffside Cabin because we've spent two nights here now. You spent three nights here yourself. You got to be here.
Moving in.
You're moving in.
Ryan's never leaving.
One step closer to squatter's rights.
Yeah. Every day is closer to squatter's rights. And like, I got up here last night. We got here fairly late in the day. Well, we got there before you did because you had to go out to do the canopy tour. I didn't do the canopy tour because I'm terrified of heights, so I'll let you do that on your own. And then Tegan and I just got back here and we started prepping like the fire and getting like the place ready and waiting for the food to arrive and then realizing the order never went through. all this chaos.
Well, I sat at the bar having a drink. And yeah. I'm just like, well, wait a second. You guys are closing up now. Where's my food?
Yeah. But incredible service. And they, incredible, you know, service. The chef came in after 8 o'clock.
They hooked me up.
Yeah. They hooked us up. My bad.
They turned the ovens off and everything, but they turned them back on. Just heated everything back up. And
yeah. And
they're 15 minutes.
Yeah. And there's three of us here, but it's a 4-bedroom and it'll sleep 10 people comfortably. Right. And the way we designed it was we figured like a lot of families, particularly after the pandemic, you know, would be wanting to travel together. And we figured a lot of couples, whether, you know, like my sister and I like to get together and with our husbands and our children and stuff. And this is the ideal location for that, right?
We're less than 10 yards from the cars.
Yeah.
And we're up on top of this giant cliff overlooking, it feels like half the known universe when you're looking out there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And but it's safe, you know, there's the railing there, but it's also like natural barriers, right? Like I find that with my own kids is that unless you're like right on a cliff edge, they know, right?
And I stay away from the rocky part.
Yeah. And
there's like natural hedging of plants and stuff. And then you have like a little bit of a cedar rail fence, a little bit of a rope fence, and then just those massive white pines that are kind of like sentinels guarding over the edge of it. It's like, okay. I got some cool photos out there when I went right on the precipice of it and immediately got vertigo. I was like, I am so glad I'm not on the camping tour. Wait, I'm 300 feet above the ground. And I'd like roll myself back. I was trying to get some cool photos and immediately regretted how high up I was. But
should have brought a drone.
I should have brought my drone. Yeah. I really should have brought my drone. Sorry, my really tall tripod. My really tall camera tripod that can get really high up without ever having to have a pilot's license.
That's all right. You'll be back.
Yes, I will definitely be back. We're definitely going to be back on multiple occasions this year, hopefully. With all this growth, with all these projects, what has been one of your favorite initiatives to get moving forward?
Oh, wow.
In like the last couple of years, not like over the last 13 years you've been here, but.
Yeah, that's hard. That's a hard one. So there's kind of a three-parter. So the most exciting initiative is a hard one for me because it's always been like a lot of little things.
Mm-hmm.
But the coolest thing that I was able to organize and get going was the 2007 World Dog Sledding Championships.
Right.
So that was, you know, I actually say it was like the high point of my career in it, and it isn't. There's a lot of amazing things that have happened, but that was like a turning point in everything that I did here. And I went away. So we put the proposal in for the World Championships. I went away on maternity leave.
With Nessie.
Yeah. And I came back. Oh, no, sorry, Emmett.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was Emmett. And I came back from maternity leave and I had a year to put together a 9-day world championship dog sledding race. So myself and Cameron, our operations manager, were like the main organizers, but we had an incredible team behind us. And somehow we pulled off closing all of Halliburton Forest, which has never been done before, 2 snowmobilers for 9 days of dog sled races. And we had something like 800 dogs on site. Over the course of those 9 days, and the athletes to go with them, the accommodations and the coordination and the parking and everything. And it was, you know, a milestone in many, many different aspects because our new managing director, Malcolm, was coming in at that time and was working with us. Cameron and I had been working together a long time, but we worked on that project together and kind of set the tone for what the next, you know, few years would be after that. And it was unbelievable. We got to go on trails that nobody had been on yet and no snowmobilers out there and just these beautiful dog sled teams coming by us doing like 50-mile races and the amount of like community support and the volunteers that came out to that was incredible. So
That was in 2017?
That was in 2017. Right. Yeah. And the really kind of neat part of it is that we always brag that we're like on top of the Algonquin Dome. So we always have snow before everybody else does. And our snowmobile trails open before everybody else and dog sledding and everything. And that year we had a January thaw right before the dog sled races. Mm. And we were just biting our nails. And Peter gave this eloquent speech at the opening ceremonies and prayed to God for snow, or he had prayed to St. Peter or something. And that night, we had the hugest dumping of snow I've ever seen in January. And the races went on safely. Beautiful. And we were able to groom them and everything. And and it was just every little thing
fell together,
and it was unbelievable. And it was probably the thing I worked the hardest for in my entire life. Mm. You know, not leaving here until 11 o'clock at night, and I still lived 45 minutes away.
Right
at that time, I wasn't living up here. And it was so cool. But again, that set the tone, right? Like, if we can do cool stuff like that, imagine what else we can do here.
Yeah.
Right. So now, Cameron and I organize a trail running race.
Mm-hmm.
So every September after the September long weekend, the distances are 12K, 26K, 50K, 50 mile, and 100 mile.
Jesus.
And those 100 milers are nuts.
Yeah.
Nuts. Like, but absolutely inspiring and incredible, right? And it took me a little while to realize that the more somebody bitches about a course and complains, the more they're actually enjoying it, right? Yeah. And it's part of the adventure. And so those 100 milers leave at 6:30 in the morning on Saturday, and their cutoff time is 3 p.m. on Sunday.
Holy shit.
Right? So they're running. And, you know, somebody said to me, I could run to Quebec and back in a shorter amount of time than, or however it worked, or drive to and from in the amount of time it took me to jog it. And it's inspiring. Like, and it's such a really neat community because they're all so accepting of each other and help each other out. And, you know, if you get somebody that's really competitive, they actually don't fit in to the crowd, and they're still accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But the crowd that comes calls it the Halliburton family reunion.
Yeah.
Right. So we have stuff like that. We have Herdon and Halliburton, which Mark Sinclair operates and runs, which is an 8-hour gravel bike race. So they do a loop, as many loops as they can in 8 hours. I believe it's 26 kilometers. Don't quote me on that. But they've been running that for the last 4 or 5 years. We do weddings. We do concerts. We do everything. We have wolf howls. We do natural history presentations.
We have an observatory.
We have astronomy. Exactly. So it's a lot of moving parts. You know, we kind of say that there's 14 or 15 different businesses, but then each of those businesses have their different events and their own different branches. Mm-hmm. And it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable what I get to do and witness, right? And our team is unbelievable. And we just couldn't do it without them. And I love and appreciate every single one of them.
Cool. It's incredible. When I come here, I see like the Sugar Shack. Yeah. And then the actual Sugar Shack. You have the Sugar Shack cabin in the base camp. And then you go down past where the dog teams used to be.
Mm-hmm.
For those that don't know, there was at one point that I remember 170 plus sled dogs
in
this facility, where they were running dog sled tours sometimes 3 times a day.
Yeah.
And then things with the snow conditions changed over the years and upkeep of vet bills and everything else like that got higher and higher. Sadly, the dogs had to be luckily adopted out.
Yes, every single one of them got adopted out.
Which is like the heartwarming end of the story for me. Like, I was really worried they're out there. Like, some of them may have to get like put down or something. Mm-hmm. I was scared where that was going to go. But when you first told me, I think it was about 9 months before it went public, that the dog sled operation was shutting down, you're going into adoption, you said, no, we are not letting that happen. We're going to adopt and adopt and adopt until every dog's gone. And you did it.
Yeah.
But so anyways, that's like a whole other, that's not here anymore, so I'm not sure why I'm talking too much about it, but right below where that facility is, you have a Sugar Bush Shack that's like a 1950s style, but brand new design, a brand new make, but it's designed after the classic 1950s style Sugar Shack boilers. Mm-hmm. So your classic big maple syrup evaporators with tons of sugar bush around it, of red maple and sugar maple, and I'm sure birches and whatever other trees you can tap. That's just like, again, tip of the iceberg, what's out here. Like, there's so much here that I've always been in love with this place. And I've said for years, if we can get Canadian, like one of my first interactions with anybody at Halliburton Forest was going to the previous general manager, Dave Bishop, trying to convince him to have Canadian Bushcraft be here.
Right.
Like 15 years ago.
Yep.
Coming this fall. Like literally a month after I founded the company brand, I went to Dave Bishop and he went, we're not really looking for anything like that. And now we're here.
Arms are wide open.
Trying to get this to happen.
I've been begging him for years.
Yes. And in my defense, several of those years were the pandemic, so we couldn't be.
True.
But yeah, we're here and we're hoping to move forward with a lot more projects as a teammates, as a kind of an alliance. I don't want to say outright partnership because that sounds a lot more like business purchasing and stuff, and that's not what's going on. We're just going to be here teaching some workshops, teaching classes, hoping to be teaching a lot of classes and workshops.
Cohabitation
is a good way to look at it.
Build a community.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. That's it.
Yeah.
The community building. One of the parts of the community building I'm really excited to be doing is the paddle shop. I picked up a brand new paddle this past week, just yesterday at the paddle shop with a free hand grip or free grip or whatever it's called.
He hasn't let go of it yet.
It's so freaking awesome. I'll let Ryan talk about the paddle shop in a minute. Like when you walked in there, your eyes lit up. Like you were.
Yeah, it was like a kid in a candy shop. Yeah.
We're stopping by tomorrow. Like we've already been there once. We're stopping by to say hi to Corey again tomorrow on our way out. But we went in and I was like, oh yeah, that's a cool paddle. That's a really pretty paddle. That's a paddle I need. And it looks like a giant like onion bulb on the very top of the shaft. And I have mangled wrists from swinging axes stupid when I was younger to crooked knifing for 12 hours straight to just beating the shit out of myself. And so gripping a regular canoe paddle hurts like hell sometimes, especially after a few hours.
Yeah, the tendonitis starts to set in after a few hours on the lake.
Yeah. So. What's it called? You got mal de raquette, which is like the pain of the snowshoe, and you're walking in the snowshoe, and you got mal de coteau crochet, or however you pronounce it, the pain of the crooked knife.
Yeah.
What's the word for paddle in French? I have no idea, but it's mal de that. That right there. My wrist just locks up. It becomes hard. Like, I've caught myself on, like, six-hour paddles trying to paddle with just one arm, tucking in the grip into my wrist and using my elbow to move the paddle blade. Completely useless. It does not do jack squat. I don't recommend trying it. But because my left wrist is just in too much pain. This thing is a big onion ball that I can just hold onto in any position. It's the same grip. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant concept. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, I need that. There's things I want. I need that. And it's the same wood, almost the same color of the wood of my grandfather's old canoe paddle that's in my collection. Mm-hmm. So I was like, and now I get to take out Papa's paddle in a sense and not have to beat it up, you know? So yeah, the paddle shop, that was one of the most excited eyes I've seen from you in a while.
I feel like Ryan was kind of fanboying because he's been following Corey for a bit.
Yeah, we've been following each other for at least a year or two.
I think, yeah, it was definitely reciprocal.
There's a bromance happening here.
Definitely reciprocal, for sure.
There's a bromance happening here.
Yeah, every time he posts his laminated paddles, oh my God, just beautiful patterns. You mentioned how one looked like a dragonfly wing.
Yeah.
Just the way the laminations on diagonal meeting in the center.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff. Like the electrolysis.
And yeah, the
really cool, it looks like lightning bolts and stuff when you add the nodes on either end and it kind of just zigzags and connects in the middle, and then you can add some epoxy and paint and do some crazy stuff with that. And then you guys have your big laser engraver on there too, so you can put anything you want on a paddle, sort of thing.
Yep.
So eventually we're going to have to get the Canadian Bushcraft logo.
We're collaborating. I literally spent like 15 minutes in the car yesterday when we were cruising to one of the sites looking up laminate paddle patterns so I can find one that looks the closest to a dragonfly wing, like the one that was there, but a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because I want to put an order for like a bunch of dragonfly paddles.
Oh, yeah. And Corey is so creative. Like, he's so skilled, but he's so creative. but he's also a paddler, like, and he speaks paddle. Like, I thought I was a paddler, and then I went down to an Ottawa adventure show with him, and it was just the two of us for the weekend, and the primary focus was the paddle shop, but obviously I was there to help with tourism things, and like, the Ottawa Canoe Club was there. And they came over and were just buying those paddles like candy because they understood the quality of it. And when they would come over, Corey would be speaking their language. And like, it was even foreign to me at that point, right? And about the blade size and the grips and you know, the length of the shaft and everything, right? And it was just... that's where the sales are, right? And that's the magic of Corey. And he's so kind.
And too humble.
Way too humble. Way too humble.
The paddle I end up buying, he was like, oh, that's kind of a seconds. I screwed up on the epoxy. Yeah. You can just have that. I'm like, no, dude, you need to get paid for your work. This is a beautiful paddle. And I didn't even notice that until you pointed it out to me. And I probably wouldn't have noticed for months. Right. And I wouldn't have given a shit.
Yeah.
Yep. He's too damn humble, and his work, like, he was being creative. Like, you walk in there, you see like those Viking folding chairs that people like to have at like Renaissance festivals and stuff. Mm-hmm. He had like gorgeous ones with laminates and stuff built into them. His selection of wood, of like ash and cherry and maple, like top quality grain of the wood. Every time that I looked at it, there was not a single paddle in there that had a blemish. You see something that you would consider a blemish and you look at it and realize, no, that's literally in this one, this is actually a case of that is character. Because you can see where he selected it and chose it to be there on purpose. Like, it's so much. He was making like, oh, you can see canoe paddle blade charcuterie boards in one pile off to the side. Like, he's just stockpiling all this work. And you can see the amount of passion and love he has for the projects. And it's just like, we just kind of offhand said, like, we were checking out the shop. We wanted to see what this whole place was because we've both seen the paddle shop post for like over a year now. Walked in, and one of the first things I said when we got to the wood storage part is like, this is almost like exactly what I'd be looking for to build a birch bark canoe in. And that's when we saw Corey's eyes light up.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, ooh, we might be doing collabs.
For sure.
We might be doing collabs. The sugaring paddle idea that I had earlier of doing like really cool sugaring paddles with Corey and having him develop like a food safe coating to make paddles for processing maple sugar like we do traditionally, but then be just as sexy and sleek as the ones he does for canoes. Like, all these options of collaboration that are available at Halliburton Forest.
Yeah, like, exactly. And he stockpiles stuff, but he also does custom work, right?
Yes.
You know, for my parents, for Mother's Day and Father's Day, I just went to Corey and, you know, I said, my dad has arthritis in his hands. My mom's, you know, arms are a little bit shorter. This is the type of paddling they do. It's a lot of, you know, shallow water through meandering creeks and stuff. And he's just like, okay, this is what I recommend. Right. And it's my parents' favorite paddles. And it's the same with mine. I, you know, I stole one from the shop to do a photo shoot. I've never brought it back. So that's the appeal. Cause I don't think a lot of paddle making companies go to that extent in the customer service and stuff. Right. And there's a lot of beautiful paddles out there, and I don't want to discount anything like that, but
you know, Gray Owl, Bending Branches, they're beautiful companies and they do beautiful work, but like Corey, like those companies are doing like production. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you're looking for a good, stout, production quality paddle that costs this kind of a budget, they're out there. Gray Owl paddles are one of my favorites. You always have Bending Branches. The one that you have is, I'm trying to remember.
I have Bending Branches.
You have Bending Branches. Okay, I thought it was.
Yeah.
But if you're
with Red Tail,
Bending Branches, yeah.
I've played with a couple. I've never been able to afford one.
Yeah, I have a bent shaft. I have a regular beaver tail and everything. But now I think I'm just going to go straight to Halliburton Forest.
That's what I'm saying. Like, there's another level there where like you go from like a production car to a custom car, and you're like, I can't go back.
Yeah.
I have this beautiful cherry wood freehand grip paddle. I have like 3-4 paddles in my collection. I know they're all just going up on the wall after this trip.
And I've been an aspiring paddle maker, so I'm getting a lot of inspiration from seeing what he's been doing. Like, one day, hopefully I can get to that level of doing my own and making my own custom paddles for myself sort of things.
Yeah.
And he's so humble that like if you called him up one day for advice, he'd talk you through it, right? And it's not... yeah, we're not trying to beat anybody out of it. We're trying to encourage paddling and all that, right? And
we want to do. We have so many ideas for running courses and stuff and making your own paddles and carving and stuff like that.
And it's a great facility to do something. He always needs
help over there.
Well, this is...
Like I said, I'm staying in this cabin.
That's right. That's right. On, you earn your keep.
Until Caleb comes back, you got me.
So. Yeah. Yeah. But I got to figure a way to get to Columbia from here now.
I'll drive you to Pearson.
I'll drive you there, but I'll drive.
Sure. You're coming back. Okay.
Leave his stuff in the cabin.
Yeah. I'm just going to see you as I'm flying off, loading all your pepper plants from the backyard in Pickering to drive up to Halliburton. Gotcha.
You got to take care of those reapers.
You got to take care of the reapers, or else we can't do the Big Hot Ones Challenge podcast episode.
Yeah. They'd love them up here.
Yep. Well, with all that...
I want to hear about Ryan's canopy tour experience. He hasn't told us about it yet.
That's what I was going to say. Like, there's there's two stories I want to hear. One from Ryan, one from you.
Right.
So we should start with your story because it's fairly fresh. You just experienced it yesterday. I didn't do the canopy tour. I don't do canopy tours, but I but I am intrigued. So what'd you get up to?
I thought it was great. Like, even like a lot of the experiences here would be getting the VIP kind of service. Normally... when I've been doing these sort of things, you're in a group of 30 and you're kind of heel to toe with everyone else in your group and waiting for other people to hurry up and everyone's stepping over each other. But yeah, we went on the canopy tour and the trees and everything. So it was kind of cool getting to do that after a big day. And
yeah, that was a big day.
Yeah. So it was kind of cool. It's been a while since I did a canopy tour too. So it was one of the higher ones I've been on as well. Like,
it's up there.
It's up there.
It's definitely like one of the kind, right? Like, there are lots of other canopy tours, but my understanding is like it's the longest of its kind. And when we say of its kind, it's because it's completely suspended by trees.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no man-made, you know, poles or structures or anything out there. And what Ryan got was like a taste of it. So our tours are not what you just described, which is great, right? Is that like we only take 12 to 13 people out at a time. Mm-hmm. And there's a van ride out. You get into a big Voyager style canoe and you paddle across the lake and then you go up in the trees. And Ryan got a taste of at least the tree part yesterday.
Yeah, we skipped right to the start of the track and hiking up that hill.
Though it would have been funny for you and your guide to be trying to paddle the Voyager canoe together.
just the two of them.
Like, when I've worked in summer camps with the Canadian Canoe Museum and I was running camps there, we'd take out umiaks that they had, just replicas. And it was pretty much like two people paddling it because we'd be with a bunch of 10-year-olds.
Right. Well, then you should have done it. So. Bring back some memories.
So, yeah, that was great. And we were running low on time and then I had to come back and pick up food for us and everything. So it was cool just to get out there with two of us and just walk the whole thing. And you kind of, we went at our own speed, but as well, we did a little faster than you normally would. But yeah, just going through and just chit-chatting the whole time and seeing the sights and finally getting out to that big platform overlooking
the isn't it incredible?
Yeah. You could hear the rapids below the whole time. It was just very serene and the sun was setting. And...
How tall is it?
So it depends on which direction you look, but it's anywhere from 40 feet to 70 feet. So the highest point is essentially seven stories, which is that platform, the one corner by the water, right? So it is quite high, but it never feels that way. So we have a lot of people that come with a slight fear of heights, maybe not Caleb's stature, but
there's three things going on. I have vertigo. So like you said seven stories. That's seven stories too high for my eyes to not fucking make it feel like I'm going to fall to my death. Secondly, I am a large man. If Ryan falls like 10 feet, he bounces really hard and hurts. I fall, it's like a watermelon on concrete. I'm going to splatter. It's just not going to end well. And third, as a big guy, we have a rule. We make a contract with gravity to never test its bounds and it never fucks us up. So,
that's with that said, the canopy tour is great for all abilities, for sure. As long as you can walk.
I got a lot of great photos too, so you can, you can live vicariously.
Yes, perfect. Photos. I don't get vertigo from photos, so that's perfect.
Make sure to follow me at Ryan_the_adventure_guy.
Yes. at Ryan.
Just in case you haven't yet. Yeah.
So. Or I follow you.
Or Teague's Adventures.
Yep. There's like, and that's like another aspect of like Halliburton Forces. You have a lot of social media connections of like, for the Halliburton Force shooting clays, mm-hmm. or clay shooting. You have the paddle shop, you have Halliburton Forest, you have the Wolf Center, all these Instagram accounts, the Facebook account. There's so much amazing content y'all put out. You just recorded a Tegan's Thursday.
My Thursday update.
Here while we're at Cliffside. And this consistent content you guys are producing on TikTok now and Instagram. And it really like inspires, and it also just gets people excited. And I really do recommend, folks, if you're looking for new accounts to follow, check out like the Halliburton Forest, mm-hmm. Halliburton Paddle Shop, I almost said Wood Shop, but the Halliburton Forest Paddle Shop, HF Paddle Shop, I think it is.
Yeah, H.F. Paddle Shop.
Yeah.
The Halliburton Forest one is just Halliburton, all lowercase underscore forest.
Yep.
And then we did the same thing with the clay shooting. It's H.F. dot clay shooting. Mm-hmm. And that's a new account, and it's a lot of fun. Like I've been in charge of our social media accounts for, I don't know,
quite a few years,
12 years or more now. And I've been creating content, and you know, we're always looking for new ideas and, mm-hmm. and different things to do. Today's update was really fun because I got to do it with you guys, and sometimes it's just me in the middle of the woods somewhere going on a paddle or a hike and, you know, highlighting somewhere else, and it's been really, really fun. Because we see the change in our markets. My goal originally for doing videos was to make people believe in Toronto that we had snow when they were looking at grass in their backyards to come snowmobiling.
Yeah.
And that evolved over time into these updates about talking about what concerts are coming up and what availability we have and everything. And then doing things like I've been in working on ice training, and I was in the water doing my update. In a hole in the ice in McDonald Lake, right? So I try and have some fun with it. And, you know, our crew is really supportive, and I'll bring people in and do different updates. And it's a lot of fun. But what we've seen, and I didn't think would actually, it wasn't a goal, but it happened, is it's actually empowered women. Mm-hmm. To come to the forest. So we're seeing a lot more women solo traveling with their children, coming snowmobiling, and it's really heartwarming to see that, right? Totally. Like we already had a really strong demographic of men and people coming in with families and everything, but I've had a lot of people reach out to me, or I can't even go to Peterborough now without somebody saying, "You're a Tegan," and it's really, it's nice. It's nice to see that, right? So, yeah.
Hell yeah. It's phenomenal to see the growth, to see the maturation of things that I saw starting years ago. And talking about things from years ago, there's so many hilarious stories that I know from being around here, and then ones Emily's told me, and then ones that Chris Gilmore, because Chris Gilmore used to work here. Yes. Way back when.
Yeah, he did. I learned that a couple weeks ago when I met him.
Yeah, that was one of the funniest like kind of moments, is like him and Emily at a diner one morning, like 4 years ago now, when we first started getting Hunter's Journey started. He came down to go for a duck hunt with us, and we decided to go to the diner afterwards for breakfast. And he's just talking about like, yeah, I used to work for this crazy German up in Halliburton County area, taking care of like saw work, but also like horses dragging logs out of the woods. And Emily just looks at him dead in the eye and goes, "Peter Schleifenbaum?" And he's like, "How do you know the name?" She goes, "I worked there too." And they just started like sharing war stories and these hilarious like moments that happened. On that note, what is like one of your favorite wild stories to happen here?
So by far, it has to do with blasting caps. So back in the day, you know, when it was the Wild West here and you could kind of do whatever you wanted, mm-hmm. The fellow that ran the property, Pat Waddell, I guess he would have been the general manager at that mm-hmm. time, but in a different way, right? Yeah. Like he took care of the hunting and everything, and was kind of the landlord of the property, or the superintendent, I guess.
Yeah.
So obviously beavers can pose a problem and flood out roads and different things. And back in the day, you'd go up in a plane and you would throw dynamite, whatever, out of the plane to blow up The dams, right? So at some point, this box of old blasting caps came in. So no TNT, no dynamite, like nothing that is actual explosives, but the blasting caps came in this old dusty box. They were kind of corroded and stuff. And my colleague, Cameron Ferguson, just had this gut feeling that we should dispose of these properly somehow.
Just to clarify for folks, blasting caps are the trigger mechanism for dynamite. They're not the fuse. Exactly. They're basically a special device that sets the dynamite off for you at a distance when you lob them or set them into a charge. And they can degrade mm-hmm. and start sweating out what's called nitroglycerin, which is a very unstable compound.
Yeah, as we found out. Cameron calls the OPP, doesn't get a response right away. But probably about 2 hours later, gets a call and they say, evacuate the area immediately. And we're like, oh no, what's going on here? And next thing you know, in the next hour, the bomb squad is coming from Aurelia, like you see in the movies. There's this guy in the like Michelin man like costume yes. going into our office building, and they're asking us to dig a hole in our parking lot. Do you have any sand or anything that we can use as a buffer? So
everybody had to go to the cookhouse.
We all like stood on the deck at the cookhouse while Pete, our lease and land use manager, is like digging a hole with a little bobcat that we have and building this for them. And the bomb squad guy goes in and he's got like a bucket and I guess he's got some sort of gripper or something, and he comes out three separate times, and like the box wasn't that big. It was probably a foot by a foot or something, but I guess just the way he had to take them out so delicately that he comes out three times in this suit, and every time he comes out, they actually detonate them in our parking lot. Like, coolest thing ever. I have videos, I have, whatever. And like, I've seen a lot at the forest. I've, dealt with accidents. I've dealt with like so many different things. Never in my wildest dreams did I would imagine I would see a bomb squad in the middle of the forest detonating bombs. And we're talking like, boom, big geysers of dust and sand and everything going everywhere. And all these funny stories that we're picking up the pieces mm-hmm. of years and years of stuff before us, right? Well,
and that's the thing, like before Halliburton Forest was founded in 1962,
yep.
there was still logging operations happening. There was still mining operations in some parts of this part of the region, maybe not directly in the forest. Mm-hmm. There's hunt camps here that are 150 years old. Mm-hmm. There's all these old cabins and everything else that have either been repaired or are in the midst of repair or in disrepair mm-hmm. because there's just so freaking much here.
Yep.
And so much, again, 100,000 acres, literally 50 times the size of my reserve.
Right.
Like, it's insane to conceive that number.
Yeah. Even our accommodations are the buildings where like the sawmill workers lived in. Right. Mm-hmm. And they have this really cool, significant history to them that we've renovated to make them comfortable and clean and everything for housekeeping units. But everything that we have here has a story behind it. And you just got to ask the right people.
Yeah.
And it's incredible.
There's like so much unique stuff that happens here that if you come to visit, it's never the same time. Or like never the same story twice. Back around when we were getting ready to leave the area, a cow moose was struck by a truck, mm-hmm. killed. There was two calves that survived. And because Halliburton Forest and Wildlife has a zoo permit because of the Wolf Center, the M&R basically dropped them off at your doorsteps.
I got the phone call.
It was you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there was a female calf and a male calf. Sadly, something you learn about moose calves is when they're at a young age, they can die from a broken heart. Is like basically effectively what the vet techs were explaining, because one of them died through the night. Mm-hmm. And so Elka, who was the previous owner, Peter Scheibenbaum's wife, who was very, very heavily involved mm-hmm. with a lot here.
Yes.
From the dog kennel all the way to the Wolf Center to a lot of everything in between that. She basically stage that calf in the horse stables with Moose FM, ironically, playing like around the clock with dogs to keep it warm, like her dogs, and as well as her in there. A lot of the time she was sleeping through the night in there with the calf.
And her daughter Minna was in there.
Minna as well, yep. And this moose became Hershey, who was the young bull moose that I got to meet on 3-4 separate occasions. Once with my dog who broke Loot Highway.
Yep.
That first time we freaking brought that stupid asshole here. I miss him so damn much. But the first time I brought him to this forest, A, we brought him because it's like, oh, if we need to, we can throw him in the kennels with the huskies.
Right.
And then we went, he would get torn apart by those some of those huskies. He's too dumb to understand dog language.
Right.
Like a dog growls and he gets closer because he wants to know why they're growling. Like he didn't comprehend. And so I was like, okay, well, he's got to get some food and water in him. It's like minus 25 out. He's been in the car for the last 10 minutes while we're trying to figure out what we're going to do with him. Let me get him some food and water. And I take him, and we had him on a halty, one of those, similar to a horse halty. They're basically designed to go around their muzzle, not a muzzle muff or muffler or anything like that, enough because he's vicious, but to control. He was a puller. He really wanted to pull on the leash. So that way he wouldn't choke himself. But he can't have that on for eating and drinking. So I was taking that off and forgot to clip the leash back onto his collar and had like just a brain fart second.
Right.
And he looked at me, felt no pressure, and just ran. Just took off running like a bat out of hell between like oncoming snowmobiles and stuff. I'm causing untold amount of chaos in this parking lot with this stupid hound. And so I just chased that scrawny mutt down the trail, running after him, trying to catch him, trying to catch up to him because I'm fat and slow, and I see him just standing and staring at something, and I tackle him, and I was so frustrated I swatted his butt. Like, I've never hit a dog, and I've never hit one since, but I swatted his butt because I was like, you nearly got fucking killed. What the hell's your problem? What the hell are you doing? Look up, and there's a bull moose staring at us 5 yards away. I'm like, oh no, oh, we're dead, we are, he's gonna trample me and the dog. And then I see a carrot hanging out of the moose's mouth, and I hadn't seen him since he was a calf, like a year before, like maybe 9 months before. And I'm like, Hershey? And he didn't know his name. He didn't respond. He's
hey, Caleb.
What's up, man? No, but like, I was so stunned that Hershey was there because the last time I saw him, he was in a stable.
Yep.
And I hadn't heard anything about him since then.
Right.
I didn't know he was out in his own pen and all this stuff going on. That I'm like, I again, kind of like loosened my grip on the dog and he escaped again.
Yep.
But what he did was he ran into the freaking enclosure with this bull moose. And I'm like, oh, fuck. He's about to get trampled. And he starts running figure eights around Hershey's legs. And I remember, right, he was raised with dogs.
Mm-hmm.
He was raised with Rocky, the wolf dog. And like all these dogs around. Like, he's not freaked out by dogs. So I'm watching Hershey just trying to like keep an eye on Highway running between his legs. And I'm not sure if he got dizzy or just got tired or just got kind of bored. So he laid down, and I swear to God, to this day, I wished I had a smartphone back then. The dog wiggled between his legs and snuggled a bull moose. It's cute until you realize I now have to go into that pen and get my fucking dog back. And there's a bull moose between me and that dog. And what if he doesn't want me to have the dog?
Mm-hmm.
So I just stood there like an idiot until Emily and Elka walked up, and Elka was like, Hershey, Hershey. And he came over to her, and Emily just grabbed the dog and looked at me like I was an idiot. She's like, why'd you take his halty off? I'm like, because he needed to eat. She's like, not really. We could have put him in the dog kennel with a bunch of food.
Yeah. Hershey holds a special place in my heart. Like, yeah. I got the initial phone call from the M&R and called Peter and Elka right away, and they took them on. And Elka and Minna, like, you know, rightfully so, kept Hershey quiet for a long time until he was, you know, healthy and big enough and everything. But once he was old enough, you know, news got out and news reporters started hearing about him and stuff. And I brought one of those news reporters down to the barn. And at that time, he was still living with our horses, of all things. And he didn't have antlers or anything. But I had been warned that, you know, Hershey has his moose days, but then he has his horse days. Meaning, you know, like sometimes he'll come and cuddle you and sometimes he's going to stomp his feet and
challenge you.
So I get there with the reporter And I'm like, okay, we're not going to go in the enclosure, but you can get some nice pictures from outside the fence. But at that time I had been helping Ilka with horse chores and stuff like that. And I did a lot of, I've done everything. Yeah. A lot of poop scooping.
Yep.
And so I was very comfortable with the horses, and I noticed that one of them was a bit tangled, in their lines. And I couldn't leave it. Right. So I just told the reporter, okay, you just stay here, take whatever pictures. And I went in the enclosure, and at that time we had Patty the donkey, and we had the horses and everything. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to keep like a horse between me and Hershey until I can get to the horse that I need to help, right? Or a tree or something. Well, I got to a point where from one horse to the next, Hershey was kind of in the middle.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not scared of Hershey. I'm not scared of the horses. I'm used to working with animals at this point. So I kind of walking towards this other horse, and Hershey walks right up to me and puts his nose right in my armpit and just nuzzles me. And I just stood there with tears in my eyes, just petting a moose. And it was just unbelievable that like I got that phone call, and then I got to get that experience. And it was almost like a thank you that, you know, that we brought him in and took care of him. And it was unbelievable. It was so cool.
I miss him a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, do we know what happened to him?
Primarily old age. But
they don't live that long.
Well, they don't live very long, and moose don't do well in captivity. No. So unfortunately, just because of the way our facility is, it wasn't an option to return him into the wild because he got so used to humans. But I would recommend to anybody, like, whenever possible, do not put a moose in captivity, right? Like, Hershey was healthy, he was happy, he got all the vet care that he needed, but it's just not the right thing.
They're made for the boreal forest. They're made for the bush.
Yeah. And he got a lot of loving. You know, Peter, every day with his Jeep, would go cut down poplar because that was Hershey's favorite snack. And you'd see Peter in this red Jeep just with a mound of branches and leaves and everything driving over. And he'd spend hours talking to Hershey and feeding him and petting him and bringing stuff down there. And everybody had a really like intimate and really touching and close relationship with him. And and he was an attraction for years. You go to the Wolf Center in the morning, have lunch, go see Hershey the moose. And he brought a lot of visitors to Halliburton Forest.
When we brought the Brothers of Bushcraft here back in 2015. When we did the dog sledding trip.
I forgot about that.
We had Rob and Nia from Practical Survivor, Norseman from Survivalogy 101, as well as Survival Hardware, Mikhail from Emberlit, Mikhail Mercury, if we've had him on the show before. And their, I believe it was Rob's at the time, cousin-in-law, Matt, all came up to spend 2 weeks in the Canadian bush with me. And partway through, Rob was like, can we do like a dog sled tour or something? Like, do you guys know a place where we can go dog sledding? I'm like, yeah, let me give Tegan a call. And sure enough, she arranged it. Originally, there was going to be like an 8-dog or 10-dog team for me and Mikhail because we're just big guys. And then the day of, head of kennel was like, you guys aren't experienced enough to be running dog sled that big.
Right.
It's like, sure, those dogs aren't big enough to be running us that big. Like, these dogs are going to die. Like, so me and Mikhail are like worried out of our minds. We're going to get these dogs killed from heart attacks trying to drag us up that one hill on the tour.
Get the moose.
Yeah. So like originally we were a little late for what we were supposed to do. So we had to do a later trip. So we had a little bit of time to kill while we're waiting for that tour. I was like, the Wolf Center's closed during the weekdays in the wintertime. Do you guys want to go see anything else? Like, I can just kind of show you the facilities that I remember from a few years ago when Emily was I was working here. And we start walking down this trail, and Rob goes, holy shit, look at the size of that eagle. And I look up, and I'm like, where's the eagle? He goes, right in front of us. I'm like, behind the raven? He goes, that's not a raven, that's an eagle. I'm like, that's a raven. He's from North Carolina. He's seen like ravens that are the southern variety. He's never seen a northern like Halliburton raven that are like the height of a freaking eagle in certain conditions. And he's looking at this raven with all this like awe. And I go, so if you look to the left of it, there's a moose. And he goes, what? And he just sees Hershey for the first time and blew his mind. And like we all walked up to the fence, and like Norseman is always very nonchalant, not impressed. He plays off very cool hand Luke kind of tone of like, that doesn't faze me. And you see him like in awe. He's like 10 feet away from a bull moose. And he's like, what the hell? Mikhail's looking like, trying to make the jokes he always makes. Like, oh, like we can make a big meal out of that guy. It's like, he would trample us before any of us got a knife on him. Mikhail, calm down. You're not going to win this one. He's a good size bull at that point. It was like 2015. Like he was mature.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the whole trip afterwards, we did the dog sledding tour. Mikhail gave his Subway sub to some of the dogs because he felt so, it was just like meat and cheese, but he felt so bad that these dogs had to drag him everywhere. He was like bringing them and giving them snacks. And like, we're not supposed to feed the dogs Subway subs, but Emily doesn't work here anymore. It's not my problem. Like, Tegan might get chewed out, but Tegan can handle getting chewed out. She works here. But then they were all like, can we go back and see the moose? I'm like, I mean, we got to get home, but yeah, let's go. They want to go back and see that moose. Like, they all got touched by that bull.
Yeah. Well, he used to come up to the fence and let people tickle his nose. Yep. And, you know, we've had so many social media influencers with the, you know, the picture with Hershey in behind or nose to nose with them.
And he wasn't the first moose here. There was a moose before.
Yeah.
That had brain worm, I believe is what the theory was. He was, because he was a mature moose when he kind of showed up. He wasn't a calf.
Yeah, he was really, he was like the friendly neighborhood moose.
Right.
So there was concern that as his condition deteriorated that he'd end up hurting somebody or himself.
Right.
It's kind of the story that I understand. I believe his name, they called him Mortimer.
Something like that.
Yeah. It was with an M or something.
Yeah.
And, but like, staff members would put their kids on the on his back, and like he was super friendly, but he didn't last very long.
No.
I think he was only around for like a month or something.
Yeah, it was, but he would follow, from what I remember, he would follow Elka around like a puppy.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
And so like there's stories of like Elka having to go deal with people that weren't happy with their campsite. And Elka's like, she wasn't a tiny woman, but she wasn't a big intimidating person.
No, yeah.
And so you'd see this lady walking up and you just picture like the macho bullshit and the guy says like, I'm going to chew her out. And then you see her coming up over the hill. Yeah, oh, she's tiny. I can yell at her. And then antlers. And then giant moose just follow her like, Mom, I love you. I love you, Mom. And she comes up. So I heard there's problems. No, ma'am. Yeah.
Yeah, no.
It's this place has been, since day one, very unique to me. And it's a very magical place. And like, It drew you in, it's drawn Ryan in, it's drawn me in, it drew Emily in, it drew almost like Christina Yu, who came out here to do the bark harvest with us in 2019. She is so keen on Halliburton Forest. Mm-hmm. Like every person that comes here falls in love with the place.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unbelievable. Like I was only here, well, I started in April, and in August we used to have the Forest Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, my husband and I were engaged and couldn't decide, you know, if we were going to get married in Sudbury, Halliburton. And we went to the Forest Festival, which used to be an outdoor amphitheater along the shorelines of Bone Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And different concerts and everything on a floating dock, right? So you're overlooking this lake. And we were sitting there watching a concert and we said, we're getting married here.
Yeah.
So, you know, like there's so much of this property that is ingrained in me and so many memories that I've created with my family and everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, over the last 3 or 4 summers, you know, I've paddled a different lake every Tuesday night. This summer, not so much, but I've paddled over 50 lakes on the property and, you know, I'm bushwhacking into them. And but I do that with my kids too, right? We go up to some of the remote campsites and we paddle in. And then from that end of the lake, we're bushwhacking into lakes that don't even have names on the property map. And, you know, there's so many opportunities. And I always tell the people, like, it's kind of like a choose your own adventure. You can come and you can do all the comfortable things. You can do the car camping that's close to the comfort station and the well and the Wolf Center and do that typical camping where you're like biking to the restaurant and the store. And, you know, I remember like the freedom of being a child on a bike and being able to go to the store and have ice cream without your parents. Right.
Yeah.
So you can do that kind of stuff, but then you can also go further into the forest
and
do some bushwhacking and, you know, like be light on the land and leaving no trace and stuff like that. But you can go to a lake, not hear a person, not see a person. Same with some of our hiking trails even, right? Like we don't want thousands of people here all the time. And our pricing structures kind of work that way with the day passes and stuff. But at the same time, we want people to enjoy things. But I always say to people, like, if you want to come hiking here, you might not see somebody on the trails. And that's a selling point for a lot of people and the people that we want here too. Mm-hmm. But then we've developed trails where you are going to see people. Like there's a Wolf Center loop. There's a forestry walk. There's, you know, John's
You're working trail. On a marsh boardwalk right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Eventually we'll be adding to that. Like we just put in a beautiful walk around Chesil's Pond and there's like a beautiful observation area. And we're hoping over the coming years to be able to put in some more boardwalks here and there. Hopkinson Pond Trail. It's iconic. It's been around for many, many years. And we just redid one section of it and we still have to do the other one, but it's open and people can use it. And, you know, that's all kids need. They just want to go out and do a short little hike. It's not even a kilometer long, but they want to check out frogs and turtles and catch bugs and get dirty. And yeah, so it's incredible. You know, even in the spring, we come out when there's still a little bit of like a crust on the ground and no bugs, no leaves. You can just see far and wide, right? And there's viewpoints you would never see with the leaves on. And there's babbling brooks and stuff, right? It's just, it's this incredible, magical place that we live in. And our community, you know, really supports it and thrives because of it.
And that's really what it is at the end of the day. It's a big community. Like Peter and Elka treated Emily like family.
Yeah, same with me.
They treated... these days, like I've known you and Andy through the forest and through Emily working here. And I look at Andy like a brother and I look at your kids like my nephew and niece. And like the relationships that are built up here and forged up here through the staff, through the community that comes through the neighboring communities. It's that, it's community. It's a big, happy tribe.
Yep. And we all stay in touch.
Yeah.
You know, like I have a friend that when I first started here, she stood in our wedding. She's from the UK and she's coming next week with her child, who's my goddaughter. I'm going to get to meet her for the first time. And, that was 13 years ago. Right. And, for the most part, I mean, some people come and go, but, you know, the people that it really meant a lot to, and we've built relationships with, we've all kept in contact, yeah. Sam, Belta,
yep.
Jenny, Bree, you know, that whole group, Rob, right?
Robbie and Rob,
all the stories, right? And this is the same, like Cameron's been here 15 years, I'm 14, Pete's 13. And, you know, we're the management team on the tourism and rec side and we love it. Right? Like Pete grew up here. He had a leased campsite as a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cameron's come from Scotland and has never stayed in a job as this long, right? Like, and he probably has, but it doesn't feel that way, right? Like we're so passionate about the property and what there is here.
100%. It's a beautiful place and you can find out more at halbernforest.ca.
.com. Yeah.
You anti-patriotic people. Look at you. Halbernforest.com. You can also find them on Instagram, TikTok, pretty much every social media outside of YouTube. Do you have a YouTube channel as well?
So we have YouTube. I'm really bad at keeping it up to date. You don't.
She
have
says Twitter. The guy that hasn't put a YouTube video out since 2018.
Yeah, that's. I've probably done something since then.
But. Yeah, I haven't. We haven't put Jack Squat out on YouTube in forever. We've been talking about it for like 3 years now to get back into it. But yeah. My God, it's hard to start up again.
Yeah.
But check them out everywhere you can. Is there anything else you want to say to the folks about Halbern Forest or yourself or from yourself to the folks?
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, come up. You know, we've talked about Halbern Forest, but the entire community is beautiful. We have a sculpture forest here. There's the water trail system that we all like going paddling on and camping at. And
you're not too far from the Halbern Highlands either.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And the Minden Wildwater Preserve is here, you know, world-class rapids. And there's so much going on in the area that like you can use Halbern Forest as a base and do all these different things or stay somewhere else. You know, we work with multiple different accommodation partners in the area and just to bring folks here. And then I would be remiss to not mention Yours Outdoors.
Of course.
At some point in this.
How did I forget? Oh, right? My God.
Halfway through, I was like, I got to bring that up. And then you just kept talking on something else.
Yeah.
Yours Outdoors, phenomenal organization that was purchased by Halbert Forest two years ago.
Three years ago. Yep.
Barry Martin. And then Pine Martin. Martin Pine, a good friend of ours. Hi, Martin. Hope you're doing well, brother. I think your name is the most brilliant marketing strategy for an outdoors person.
Oh, it sure is.
His name is Martin Pine. You say it backwards, Pine Martin. It's perfect.
Yep. Yeah. So people like Martin Pine, Steve Gallia, Stevie Funfer, Jen and Terry from Arctech Designs. So there's, like, there's so much going on. The whole concept of Yours Outdoors is bringing people into people's homes or backyards or their studios and giving them those off the beaten path, really unique experiences. So anything from glass blowing and glass fusion, mineral collecting,
historic trapping and muzzleloader stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Like, working with Craig McDonald.
Yes.
You know, looking at snowshoes over the history of, you know, the history. Mike Buss, we do like a fir and flintlock program, looking at the fur trade, fly fishing, tin boat fishing, ice fishing. It's like anything you can think of, we probably can make it happen for you. And Barry just retired at the end of June, and he was a huge mentor of mine. I had the privilege to be one of the speakers at his retirement party, and I met him when I was in college. I worked with him at Trails and Tours when I started at the Forest. You know, we worked closely together, so I was very honored that when it was time for him to start thinking retirement, that he looked at me, but also the Forest for succession. And Malcolm saw the value in it, our managing director, and we purchased it from him. It was meant to be a year, and then the pandemic hit. And so we got 3 years out of Barry. but now he's living life. I saw a post yesterday. He's like, 12 days and I'm still retired. And he's hanging out with his grandchildren. So
over in Quebec, yeah?
Yeah, he was over in Montreal for a bit. So he had, part of his family has moved to Haliburton recently.
Oh, right on.
But he has two grandchildren out in Quebec. So his legacy will live on. We will never be Barry Martin. We can never replace him. And things will never be exactly the same. But we hope to do it justice, and yeah, if I keep going, I'll cry.
You're on the verge, so we're gonna move along from that and just simply say thank you very much for the last over an hour and a half of your time sitting with us.
Thank you
again, folks. If you're trying to find out more about Haliburton Forest and Wildlife, go to HalibertonForest.com.
Yep.
As well as their Instagram, Haliburton.Forest. Or the underscore. Dot and underscore always throw me off. I'm always like, it's Ride Dot the Adventure Guy. And everyone's like, no, it's not. I looked. It's like, oh, it's an underscore again. So Haliburton underscore Forest. Add on Instagram. You can find out more from the paddle shop on Haliburton Forest's Instagram page as well. They've got a bunch of their other links over there as well.
And yeah. Canadian.bushcraft.to.
So. Yes. Very soon, Canadian.bushcraft is back too. So because we finally got access to some folks at Meta to help us fix our damn account and get it unhacked. So yes, you'll be seeing much more on that page as well as our CanadianBushcraft.to account, which is going to be going back to being the Canadian Bushcraft podcast Instagram account. But yes, you'll be seeing a lot more content on there very soon from all of us, as well as from in the future with a lot more projects together.
Super excited.
Very excited. With that being said, I want to give a big shout out to our Patreon, specifically one patron, Andy Legg.
Whose
wife is sitting here, and he's going to get an entire hour and 37 minutes of listening to his wife talk. This is going to be brilliant. So I hope you're doing well, brother. Thank you. And to all other supporters over on Patreon, thank you very much for your support. We will be back to you with a lot more articles, a lot more posts very soon. If you want to become a supporter of Patreon, go over to patreon.com/CanadianBushcraft. Go on there for as cheap as $1.50 a month. A cup of coffee a month can cover you as a supporter for us. The further up you go, the tiers, the more support and the more kickbacks you get from us. So go over to patreon.com/CanadianBushcraft today and become a member of the Dragonfly Nation. Thank you very much. Hope you folks are doing well. Take care until the next episode.